I hope you know Rebel Radio is supported by Audible. Love them for that. You know, if you talk to most people about living in LA, they'll say the worst thing about it is the traffic. You know me, I really don't mind the traffic because I use it as my listening time. I listen to books on Audible, and it's really changed my career, my whole reading, all of that. There's an unbeatable selection of books on Audible. I listen to fiction, a lot of mysteries, business books, personal growth, biographies. I just finished a great book called Let's Go Crazy, Prince and the Making of Purple Rain, written by Alan Light. It's if you're a Prince fan, you got to get into that one. I'm about to start on The Drop by Dennis Lehane, which looks cool. I go through like a book a week, something crazy like that, because I use my time in the car, in the gym, on the bike. Whenever I'm on a conference call ignoring everybody, I'm listening to Audible. Go to Audible and get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial, audible.com/rebel. That's a special code only for fans of Rebel Radio. Because we love you, we hook you up. audible.com/rebel.
My name is Brent Bushnell, and so excited to be here on Rebel Radio. I'm the CEO and co-founder of 2-Bit Circus.
Fuck you, Josh.
That's awesome. What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
What did you say, Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
Hey, what's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the show where every week we talk to the Rebels who are shaping youth culture. We find out why they do it, how they do it, and what you can do to get a little piece of the pie for yourself. We're also the only show that features new music every week from the homies over at EDM.com. Hey, this week I'm coming to you as I speak. I'm looking out of my hotel room over the Hong Kong Harbor. It's amazing out there. I'm in the middle of a three-week trip. I've been in Tokyo, Beijing, Taiwan, Hong Kong. Can't wait to get home next week and share some interviews that I recorded in Beijing with people that are running the nightlife, the music and art scenes in that city. Some really cool stuff to share with you when I get back. But this week we have one of the smartest interviews I've done in a while. This guy was amazing. Brent Bushnell is my guest today. Brent is the founder of 2-Bit Circus, which is building micro amusement parks. They're about to launch their first one in Los Angeles in January. And he's really reinventing family entertainment using VR and other technology combined with, you know, the old familiar entertainment of our childhood and before. He's going to talk about his journey into the family business. He's got a really famous father who was an innovator in family entertainment. I'll let you find out about that for yourself if you're not familiar with Brent and his story. He gives us some simple but powerful techniques for hiring people with passion. And talks about the company that he's building that's going to change the face of what your kids are doing. Really good stuff coming up this week on Rebel Radio, right after our EDM.com track of the week.
Yeah, I'm back. 17, let's go. Yeah. Okay. Primero. Yeah. Upper middle class, but the fan for the ghetto. Yeah. Cousin locked up, cause he did it for the dinero. Yeah. Go and get it, Papa, say you signed with the devil, whole lot. A lot of things change. Really hard to do it for the love when it's pain. A lot of people say what they want, like the yay, but the two hype kids really need to go and play. Okay. Used to dress like you in 08. I went up two in one day. You really sound like old man. Woo. Yeah. I tell you everything that you know, I'll expose you. Yeah. Watch what you say, young boy, I'll expose you.
Yeah. I wanna say your name, people pay for that exposure. Yeah. QQQ to the day really over.
Yo, that was Majid with a track called Primero, your EDM.com track of the week. Get over to EDM.com, check out new music, and check out Brent Bushnell here on Rebel Radio.
Yeah. I don't give a fuck, you don't fuck.
That's funny. So true. That one seems harder to remember.
Yeah, it is a little harder.
Yeah, yeah. Cool, man. Well, thanks for doing this.
Oh, dude, so happy to be here. Thanks for coming.
And I appreciate you having us in this incredible.
Cool. Wonderful. You know, it's a. Did I tell you a little bit of the story of this? You know, I mean, it's
a big old
power plant. So, yeah. Built in 1903, yeah. Edison Electric Company. There's photos of this place, literally with nothing for miles, and the five is basically a footpath. You know,
wow.
So it's really fun.
That's so cool.
This building scene a lot.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. I bet. That's awesome. So. I always like to get into, how people got started and where you came from. I'm guessing, you know, all my usual questions kind of go out the window because I'm guessing you had a really unique childhood.
It was definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet.
It was, you know, my dad's big nerd, and so he really raised us as nerds.
Yeah.
And introduced us to Dungeons & Dragons really early.
Right.
And, you know, introduced us to the internet when there was like literally 100 computers on it. I mean,
wow.
I'll never forget sitting there looking at Mosaic, that early uh-huh. web browser.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, hey, this is the internet, Brent, like, check it out. And I stayed there, and I like read the help menu for a little while, and
yeah.
I was like, "Just what am I even looking at?" You know, it was also funny. He trained us to program really early,
right.
And we sat there all afternoon. And by the time we were done, a little white dot moved across the screen,
uh-huh.
And I was like, "Dad, I don't think this is for me." You know, like that it was for, this is like punishing. You know, but it was
that's funny.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you, I went to, when I was 10, I went to Camp Calabasas.
Oh, yeah.
For summer. It was like a day camp. And this was like a big deal that this is the first year they had a computer track. So you could opt in for 9 to 12 was computers, and 12 to 3 was, you know, swimming and doing all the regular camp shit. And so I did that, and we were on Atari 800s. They
wow.
had 800s and 400s. In the room, and the 400, I'm sure you remember, like the 400 had the, not virtual keypad, but like they weren't like raised keys.
Yep.
And we'd sit there all day.
Awesome.
Making the screen change colors, like writing these really primitive scripts.
Well, in the early days, you know, people were asking him, you know, as people were plugging this stuff into their TVs, they were like, how do you get the TV station to change like
yeah.
that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a concept that you could plug something into your TV and it would locally create that sort
right.
of, those visuals was really an anathema, you know? Yeah.
Were you a gamer as a kid, I imagine?
Totally. Oh
yeah.
My God. We loved video games, and not just video games, board games,
yeah.
card games.
Yeah.
You know, we as a family played tons of games, lots of that stuff. Dad's always been obsessed with games, and
sure.
so we were always exploring a lot of the new stuff, and as a result played very little Atari, interestingly
is
enough.
Is that right?
Yeah, because he was always bringing home the latest stuff.
Right, right.
So we'd have, you know, why are we going to play the old stuff when the brand new Nintendo is here and the
yeah.
crazy hard to get a hold of, you know, Japanese Famicom and
sure,
all these
sure.
different things. We were like, yeah, okay, Atari, whatever. You know, it was really fun,
of course,
to have
yeah.
all the new stuff.
Well, the rest of us were excited when the new Atari stuff came out. What was it? Was there a favorite game? Was there like the one game that was all about?
You know, we as a family actually have this one game that we all just play a ton of and we're super competitive around. It's called Pengo. P-E-N-G-O.
Okay.
Most people have never even heard of it.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like Pac-Man, but you can reconfigure the walls. And
okay.
And it's just, if for some reason, it just really got under our skin.
Yeah.
And we used to have family tournaments and that kind of stuff. So that was a big game. A bunch of my brothers... A bunch of my brothers and dad all got obsessed with Magic the Gathering.
Okay.
So we played that a lot when it first launched,
yeah.
Building out all our own decks. We got so obsessed with it, we actually made our own version, a sci-fi version. You know, Magic the Gathering was very sort of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
We also really liked sci-fi and space and whatnot. So we made a sort of interplanetary version of that we called Worlds.
Yeah.
And we actually licensed it to Topps Baseball Cards. My brother Tyler and I missed tons of school, you know, and went to Kinko's, you know, printing out our own cards to make delivery deadlines and really had a ball both playing games but also building our own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's That sounds like a lot of fun. Yeah. Fun way to grow up, I'm sure. I was listening to a podcast with your dad. I think it was How I Built This.
Oh, yeah.
Recently, and I mean, just a fascinating story. You know, I particularly loved, like, he described launching Chuck E. Cheese.
Yep.
And how, like, you know, we're... Kind of what he said is like, we're making all these games, but now we get to build a place where people go to play the
games. It was literally a go-to-market strategy for the games. Yeah. You know, think like Michelin guides to sell more Michelin tires.
Right.
And so for them, at the time, arcades were CD places. Right. And so if you were Atari, you could get, you know, you can get games in front of 16 and 17-year-olds, 15-year-olds, but, you know, for a 6-year-old, that was not a place you were going to, a family was going to go. And so Atari Labs, which was really a prolific part of Atari in terms of just throwing a lot of stuff against the wall, a lot of churn, a lot of experimentation, was literally in a separate building from Atari. Atari was down in the Valley, and Atari Labs was up in Grass Valley, Northern California. And so, you know, that creative environment had all sorts of interesting stuff come out of it, including a freaking internet, right? They were working on their own dial-up modems to share scores and stuff. But one of the things was this restaurant.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dad sells Atari to Warner, and they, you know, at the time, they knew how to sell, you know, records and the concept of sort of plastic with information on it that could be replaced in the home made a lot of sense, same kind of thing, so the cartridges made sense. But they were like, well, this restaurant, we don't really get it. So Dad ended up buying that and running it, turning it into Chuck E. Cheese. And
amazing.
You know, it was that safe, family-friendly place that was a go-to-market strategy for the games, but then also, you know, became its own right.
Sure. So were you in the family business from as a kid? Was that like, was that your path?
Well, so, you know, Dad raised us with kind of one foot in engineering and one foot in entrepreneurship. And he was always very clear with us from a very young age. He was like, listen, I'm not going to give you any money. You're going to do this on your own. Like, I've watched what happens to kids who are given a lot of things and don't have hardship. Like, he was a self-made man, you know, grew up in Utah. His dad died really young, and so he worked really hard from a very young age. And he expected that of us. And so he would twist our toes in the morning to get us out of bed to go weed the garden, and, you know, was always sort of pushing us to do stuff. You know, hey, go sell stuff at the bottom of the driveway. Go sell stuff at the, you know, and we sold mistletoe wrapped in red ribbon at Christmas. We made our own jewelry and sold out in front of the supermarket. We, you know, I sold candy bars for my baseball team, sold magazine subscription sales. Like, we were always out there pushing stuff.
Yeah.
And so he would, you know, I have 7 siblings, which is a lot of kids, right? And so, you know, that his, parental attention sort of distributed across 7, you might think, God, did we get any time at all?
Sure.
And the one thing that was really powerful was he would take us one-on-one on trips.
Mm.
And so he would take us to business meetings, and he would take us, and this was this very special time with Dad to go and one-on-one travel with him wherever he was going. But you would not only get the sort of one-on-one time with him, but you would also go into the meeting, and he'd be like, okay, you're not going to say anything, but here's what's about to happen, and here's what I expect to get out of it, and then we'd have the breakdown after the meeting. Here's
that.
What happened, and so it was really wonderful to be there on the ground, you know, a part of it, both getting to spend time with Dad, but also getting a real window behind the scenes of, you know, what business was like and what that meant. And so we spent time playing games and going exploring new stuff, and we spent time, you know, building business and working on our own stuff.
Is there a central lesson you think you learned from that approach to parenting?
A few, you know, one that, you know, really, really pushing your kids to develop that grit, right? Yeah. You know, Dad used to always say, mom is always going to protect you from the world, and I'm going to give you doses of how hard it can be, you know, and it's going to be little pieces, but, you know, Dad was sort of the bearer of bad news, and mom was always going to be sort of the good news. But he was, you know, it wasn't mean or malicious. It was very much like, hey, the world's hard and you guys better like shape up, you know. And he used to call us hothouse plants, you know, and that was such a derogatory term to be hothouse plants, you know, so we never wanted to be that. But he would really, you know, push us. So I think that was really important, pushing us to work all the time, you know, really, you know, effort tracking with reward. But here, you did a thing. Great. Here's you know, an allowance for having done that specific thing. Here's, you know, know, a hard challenge to go after, and here's how you can do it. You know, I was a terrible baseball player, but sold, you know, candy bars for my baseball team. Yeah. And he was like, okay, if you're going to do this, what's your lingo? How are you going to go out and approach somebody at the supermarket? You need to have a quick button down thing. Nice. You're going to say. And yeah. So he really coached us on how to go and do it, and then would turn us loose. And so one of, you know, in terms of sort of early business formation, something he's always been really, you know, serious and strict about is go out and do something today. Don't just like think about what it could be, like try something now to, you know, right this minute. You know, yeah. If you have an idea for a business, it's not enough to just sort of think about it abstractly. What's the smallest, easiest version that you could demonstrate there's an appetite for and prove it today? Don't even build the thing. Build the marketing materials for the thing and yeah. see if you can sell it. And yeah. if you can sell it, then you can go and build it. But not until you have really engaged is it, you know, is it worth spending your time on.
Sure.
And, you know, and so I think that was always a big thing.
So when have you used that?
All the time yeah. since then, you know, I mean, we try, and even all of 2-Bit Circus has been very much about rapid prototyping mm-hmm. and coming up with something, building it as fast as possible. And, you know, my co-founder, Eric, we'll talk about something in the morning and have a working version in the afternoon. And as soon as possible, cool. putting it in front of either our staff or the public or something to be able to figure out what works and what doesn't. And yeah. and the times when we have not done that and have just gotten super excited about something and taken a ton of time to build it, only mm-hmm. to put it in front of people and they are like, what is this? You know, has been the disasters, right? The stuff where we put it in front of people and saw, wow, our premise was wrong. This other thing, the debug mode is super cool. Whatever we were building is was a waste of time, but mm-hmm. this other thing is super neat. And you know, we've just time and again learned that rapid iteration is invaluable.
Yeah. So given that environment and that upbringing, like, was there an aha moment when you realized this is my path? Like, you know, when did it kind of officially start for you? Was there yeah. something that triggered that?
You know, it was really collaborating with my co-founder, Eric,
yeah.
because, you know, I would say that we, because of Dad's approach of, you know, you're going to do this on your own, we all left the nest like, hey, we're really going to do it on our own. Like, I'm not even going to go into games and entertainment. That's Dad's thing. And so, you know, I worked in fiber optics and DNA synthesis and auto wow. salvage and, you know, ERP systems and all this other stuff and really cast a wide net on sort of what it was I was going to work on. And it was really only when Eric and I started collaborating. At first, we were just making interactive art for fun that we mm-hmm. would take to parties, and mm-hmm. and then the art turned into games. And all of a sudden, I was like, "Oh my God, what the hell have I been doing? I know so much about games. I love this space so much. Like, why am I not working in this?"
Yeah.
But it really took sort of, you know, kind of a 15-year path to
wow.
figure out, like, hey, it's okay to still work in that stuff. You mm-hmm. know, like I sort of had successes elsewhere and was able to come back in and enjoy it.
Yeah, sure. And what was the first hit? Like, when, so you say, like, all of a sudden, like, this is working. What was that?
You know, it wasn't a hit, but it was something that was, you know, really a ton of fun. You know, have you done an escape room? Have you
yeah.
heard about those? Okay.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
we got obsessed with this category of entertainment in, like, 2010 maybe.
Okay.
And so you didn't even really have a term yet. Escape rooms weren't a thing. But we wanted a live action adventure where we were the character, right? More like Michael Douglas in The Game than controlling a video game with your thumbs.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to be the character. And what happens when you are the character is you have to use all your faculties, not just your hand-eye coordination controlling a video game,
right.
but you might need to be flexible. You might need to know, you know, about Chinese history. You might need to know a bunch of different things. And so we made a spy adventure that overlaid on top of this whole complex that we're in right now. And over the course of it, you had to get across a room of laser beams. You had to do a game of observation with this huge gigapixel image. You had to drive
Amazing.
Really fast in a driving simulator.
Yeah.
We had our girlfriends at the time. We filmed them as these Charlie's Angels, you know, spy people, because you were basically trying out to be a part of their spy club.
Cool.
And so it was video production. It was game design. It was, you know, experience design. It sort
yeah.
of touched a lot of domains. And as a part of that, we were working with a seamstress and a video game designer. And a mechanical engineer, and we were doing all, you know, all the infrastructure. And so here was this thing that there was no template for. We were mm-hmm. just sort of building this, connecting as many different parts as we could. And, you know, it was you know, super labor intensive, really low throughput, all sorts of reasons why this shouldn't work as a business. But it was a ton of fun. Yeah. And so that was for me an early moment where it was like, wow, this could be a thing. And we, on the back of that, I actually went out to try to raise money. It was the first time I was trying to raise money. And it was all but sort of like laughed out of the room. You know, location-based entertainment, what are you talking about? Like, we invest in the internet.
Right.
And so, you know, and they were right. We weren't ready to take money or turn that into a huge business. But that space, the kernel of that, has been something that we've sort of danced with ever since, you know, for going on 10 years. And now with our micro amusement park, it's really the culmination of so many projects, including that one.
Yeah.
And we are finally ready, you know. And I think at the same time that the appetite from consumers is ready, they want immersive entertainment. And so I'm really quite excited about that.
Yeah, so can you talk about the amusement park?
Sure.
How much can you tell us?
Well, so we, you know, as a company, Eric and I knew we wanted to play with new technology and immersive entertainment, public attractions, but not enough that we knew, you know, how it was going to monetize in the beginning. And so we just did a lot of consulting work, worked with brands building attractions to help Samsung tell their story about Gear VR, and Dave & Buster's do stuff, you know, new kinds of attractions in their places, and Warner Brothers and whatever. So we did lots of those kinds of attractions, and we were building that stuff to put them inside of CES and Comic-Con and South by Southwest. And that was all really fun and interesting, and we build the thing and we install it and we run it for all the week of South by Southwest. But there was always this frustration where we've set this thing up, you know, we've built it for 6 months, we install it for the week, and then when the conference is over, where does that thing go, right? Mm-hmm. It takes physical space. It's now going to have to go to a warehouse, or worse, in the trash.
Right.
And so that was always a frustration for us. And so this amusement park, this what we call a micro amusement park, because it's small for an amusement park, but huge for a retail complex. I mean, this thing's 50,000 square feet.
Oh, wow.
We're putting right in the middle of downtown LA, and it's really a place for those kinds of attractions, that immersive entertainment that doesn't have a home somewhere else. And when I think about entertainment, there is passive entertainment, movies and theater and books, and there's interactive entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, video games is maybe the one we're the most, you know, close to, but immersive theater is a domain that's really growing. Yeah. Virtual reality is getting really interesting. Augmented reality is coming. Escape rooms are another great example of immersive entertainment. And all of that whole category for me, you know, sits inside of this other, you know, this interactive entertainment, this immersive entertainment that requires more than just your your ability to use your thumbs. And so this is a platform for that stuff.
Yeah.
So we open early next year, and we're hard at work. You know, you can probably hear the grinding and welding going on behind us. So hopefully it doesn't screw the audio quality. you know, there's so much stuff getting built right now, and we're building a lot of it. We're also working with a bunch of partners to showcase stuff. And LA is a template that we're going to take all over the place.
That's exciting. I mean, it's exciting because, you know, I mean, everything, you know, most of what you hear about is digital, right? Is you know, obviously video games exploded, the internet. Now, you know, we've seen these companies, you know, come out of nowhere and now reach a billion people. And so, you know, every time I'm meeting with marketers or with media people, like, it's always about scale.
Yep.
And a lot of them have heard me say that I think that focus is a mistake.
I love that you say that.
Yeah, they don't like it.
You're right.
But I don't care, right? Yeah. But you know, there's this assumption that anything you build needs to be, you know, at such a huge global scale.
Yep.
And, you know, I think there's, that misses something.
I completely agree. And there are sort of two thoughts around that. One is, content radiates out from live.
Sure.
And so live experience might be the least scalable one, but it's the, you know, the things that happen while you're physically there, and then you share it on your Instagram and whatever, you know, there's this concept 1-9-90. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the 1% that might be able to be there and be a part of the action. And then there's 9% that follow that 1% and really care about, you know, all the things that they're saying and doing. And then a 90% that's the sort of general consumer that are going to be peripherally aware of the thing. But that sort of radiation is really, really interesting.
I love that.
And then the other piece is, you know, that scale, we need to sort of moderate that scale conversation with the amount of immersion.
Mm-hmm.
Great, I can put up a banner ad and touch 5 billion people
right.
for a femtosecond, right? Right? You have your attention for, you know, it's so short. It's, you know, it's not gonna yeah. change much of your life trajectory.
Right.
But an entire day, 10 hours inside of Disneyland,
mm-hmm.
you know, being able to have read Harry Potter and then go to Harry Potter World and just be surrounded by that IP
yeah.
and drink butterbeer and wear the cape and walk down Diagon Alley, you know, that's immersion, mm-hmm. you know, and that is a memory that you can, that will be permanent in your brain of that time with your family and that time you were Harry Potter. That's so much more permanent than that banner ad. Yeah, sure, the banner ad's super scalable, but that immersive thing will be absolutely indelible in your mind for life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. And I love, you know, you're sort of bridging generations, right? When we think of circus, we think of, you know, Barnum and Bailey.
Yeah.
You know, we think of carnivals, we think of, like, you know, Boardwalk Empire days,
yeah,
right?
Grungy, you know, that sort of old carny.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And yet, you know, what you're building is very technology driven, it's very forward thinking. And I think that's, you know, it's a fascinating idea, you know, of like, there's pieces of the culture of our past that need to be, that still have value for people.
Yep.
And right, and how do we integrate that into a modern yeah. experience?
But, you know, people are aware of circus and carnival. You know,
yeah.
maybe, you know, younger kids have never been to one, right? Barnum and Bailey's closing down and,
yeah.
and you know, but they still exist in media and people
sure.
sort of have this peripheral awareness of it. And if you think about circus over the ages, you know, it's been about a showcase and celebration of human capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, it was horse shows and, mm-hmm. and wow, look at how well we can, you know, perform on top of these horses. And then it was, hey, look at how much we can control animals, wild animals. I can put my head inside this lion's
right.
mouth. I can get this elephant to dance around. You know, this was sort of the height of our capability.
Sure.
And then, you know, Cirque du Soleil said, hey, you know, this whole animal rights thing is important. Like, maybe this whole animal stuff is not the good idea.
Yeah.
But humans are amazing. And look yeah. at how flexible they are and how strong they are and how much, you know, the incredible capacity of humans. And they turned that into a beautiful show.
Yeah.
And we have that same feeling and ethos, right? Humans are incredible, and now we are augmented by all this amazing technology. How can what sort of new three rings can we showcase all the cool things that are happening out there, and be a venue for that futuristic entertainment? Be a place that you can do it. I don't know if you ever read Night Circus, but
no.
I just love this book. And you know, they have all these little tents that you wander around into with all these just absolutely magical experiences. People want that whimsy, that mystery, and a way to get hands-on with you know, all this new magical stuff
that's
in a
so
way
cool.
that's not Best Buy, frankly. You
mm-hmm.
know, I mean, like mm-hmm. there's a fun way to showcase this stuff, and you know, ideally it'd be with your friends and family, and you know, you get to have food and beverage around it, and,
yeah, absolutely,
you know, make a real experience.
So, what kind of company does it take to build that future? Like, how do you think about the company culture?
Yeah.
And you know, how would you describe the culture here?
You know, it's a wild thing, because I think, you know, you talk to entrepreneurs and oftentimes people will say, hey, they were lucky, you know, and I feel that way. We were wrong for a long time. You know, we built a whole GPS-enabled smartphone game long before Pokemon Go, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, we
yeah.
built that escape room thing long before escape rooms, and it didn't work, you know.
Yeah.
And we, you know, so almost like a broken watch, you know, we just sort of always thought immersive entertainment was awesome,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden our timing was right.
Mm-hmm.
But I really feel like, you know, I couldn't describe the path to create 2Bit. It like found us,
mm-hmm.
and our timing was right, and we just sort of did the thing that we were passionate about until it worked.
Yeah.
And so it's a little disingenuous to have like a clear pathway, because we really were lucky. But
mm-hmm.
I think the thing that entrepreneurs do is sort of create their own luck, right? It's a lot about like your times at bat. How many times do you keep doing it? And you failed 99 times and you just keep doing it until something works. And you don't know which of the ones are gonna work. And you ask any movie executive, it's like, why'd you spend all that money on that movie that failed? They don't know which ones are gonna fail, right? They gotta throw a lot against the wall and then hopefully one of them's gonna work. Yeah. And so, you know, you know, I feel like that's very much at the root of this. And so, you know, for us, we, you know, I'm so thankful that we finally found some things that really have worked, and so that's been really exciting. And so I think in our culture, you know, that as we talked about before, experimentation and trying lots of stuff has been very paramount. You know, we like to play. I like to think of us as a playful company, and one that you know, embraces whimsy and a little bit of ridiculousness, and so that permeates. We actually just had our Halloween fashion show yesterday. Oh, cool. And you know, we had all sorts of cool stuff. There was a prize for most innovative cardboard thing, and you know, five of them built these cardboard cartridges, Nintendo cartridges, and they were the cartridge family. But you know, there was just such wonderful creativity, and you know, we made sure to take a half a day to celebrate Halloween and enjoy that stuff. And so I think all that stuff is definitely part of our corporate culture.
So you have, I think, a pretty big vision, and you seem like an impassioned leader, right? How do you decide when to drive that and when to kind of give people the reins?
Yeah, you know, that's such a hard question to answer. And I think that any, you know, every company has to wrestle with this, in that the things that make for creativity and innovation are almost completely diametrically opposed to structure and process and the things that sort of allow for big scale.
Yeah.
And the ones that go too far in one direction, you know, fail. Mm-hmm. And so if you are too structured and processed, you have a hard time innovating. If you're too creativity and innovative, you have a hard time scaling and staying around. And so that balance is constantly a difficult one. You know, I would say for me, I really love finding, you know, at the very beginning of a company, when there's just a handful of people, you have all the hats on. All the different hats, from accounting to legal to business development to product and everything.
Yeah.
And one thing I just absolutely love is finding someone that I can give one of those hats to, that does it better than me, you know? And we, the day we brought on a controller, I was ecstatic, you know, because I'm terrible at that, you know? And so this is something that was like incredible, to now have someone who has done that and loves it and is great at it, you know, to be able to empower them to do what they're great at. And so I think for us, as we've grown, to be able to bring on people who you know, do that work and can bring that process, but still have some of that two-bit ethos, has been important. A big question for us in the interview process is, what do you do on the weekends? Mm-hmm. You know, like, what are you passionate about? And there's this wonderful phrase I heard called uncorrelated characteristics.
Okay.
And so we're always looking for people who, you know, hey, you might be one of the most incredible controllers day to day, but you also are just awesome at fly fishing, or you love to write poetry, or you are, you know, an incredible car maker, mechanic on the side. Whatever it is, demonstration of passion in something, right? Oh my God, you're ranked, you know, Eric's literally a world ranking whistler. You wouldn't know that if you know, the first time, but he's also a freaking incredible roboticist.
Yeah.
But you know, uncorrelated characteristics demonstrate, you know, a passion for something, right? If you have the capacity for passion in anything, maybe you could bring a slice of that to here. But then also, you know, uncorrelated characteristics says you have your feet in multiple domains, and you know, creativity really comes from the intersection of domains, and oftentimes the more that you can have, you know, people that have a broad background and have touched lots of different things, they have a lot of sort of creative fodder. There's a lot of capacity for stuff that they can draw on when it comes time to do something creative. So, a couple of ideas.
Yeah. Can you think of somebody that you hired? Or that was qualified, but that you saw that the culture fit wasn't going to be there.
Definitely, you know, and I think that's, especially as you grow as a company and there's more people to talk to, more people to interact with. You know, no matter what role you're in, your capacity to interact with people is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that our school system really doesn't do a great job of, is
sure.
that, yeah, we might do really wonderfully on getting you to a score for your ACTs and your SATs and your, you know, whatever, but that EQ, your emotional quotient of being able to empathize with someone and convey a message to them
yeah.
is very important. And we have met people who are off the charts brilliant and crush all of those tests, and their IQ is tremendous. And their EQ is terrible. And so the challenge becomes, hey, great, you can do this job, you can do the technical, the quantitative part of this job you can knock out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
The qualitative part, the part that allows you to interact with everybody else in this company and maybe our customers and whatever, all those other pieces, if those aren't there too, it's not going to work, you know?
So is it hard to resist the temptation to hire those people anyway because you need a job done and they can do it?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And you, and sometimes if you can come up with a structure that insulates them, or, you know, you can hand ring and figure out ways to pull it off. But
sure.
but for the most part, looking for folks that can hit both those is really
yeah.
important.
So what you're doing is not easy. Like, wait, this is a big hill to climb.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not breaking any news to you. I'm sorry if I burst your bubble.
Oh,
just
no,
now.
Wait, are you serious? Shit. I gotta get
Yeah, that's my pep talk for the day.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm a motivational speaker
on the side.
You might not know that. Have there been times when you've questioned the mission?
Man, you know, we did so you know, I mentioned we'd done a lot of consulting for a long time, and then we said, hey, you know, we don't want to just be a consultancy, we want to make our own IP, we want to go direct to consumer, and,
yeah.
and our first big test of that was this huge carnival. We had a huge traveling carnival.
Right. Steam Carnival.
Steam Carnival.
Yeah, yeah.
We launched it on Kickstarter, and oh my God, you know, the first sort of validation that people wanted this happened, right? We got a ton of visibility, we were in Time and USA Today and on the Discovery Channel, and oh my gosh, yes. And we did two of them. We did one in LA and we did one in San Francisco. And, you know, it took a year of planning and fundraising and sponsorship and, you know, partner relations and all of this stuff. And we built all the things and we set it up for 10 days and then we operated it for 3 days, you know, over mm-hmm. that weekend. And it was absolutely exhausting. And so on the one side, there was all of this excitement and we were sold out every day and all this media coverage and people loved it. And on the other side, it literally took the company 30 days to recover.
Yeah.
Like, we literally all practically died, and this place was a morgue for a month. And that's not sustainable. And
mm-hmm.
and by the end of the second, you know, we went into the second one thinking, we're gonna tour this across the country. Oh my God, it's gonna be amazing. And we left the second one being like, no, like, we're gonna
can't
die if
well.
We do it again.
Yeah.
We can't do this again.
Yeah.
And that was really heartbreaking.
Yeah,
I
huge.
Actually, the day we made that decision, I cried.
Yeah.
Because I had poured so much of my life energy into mm-hmm. this thing, and the whole team had poured their life energy into it. I'd been out there yelling from the rooftops how amazing it would be, and had talked to every single person I could, and had spoken with brands and partners and media and everything, and it just had sold this vision. And you believe it, right? You as the entrepreneur have to believe it first before you can sell partners, before you
sure.
can sell employees, before you can sell anybody. And to come back from that and be like, no, it's not the right format, you know, and to really embrace that and realize it and then figure out how to reposition was like absolutely crushing. What did you
rely on to pull you through that?
To get out of it? You know, I've got a great board of advisors, which mm-hmm. I would think everybody on the planet should have.
Yeah.
And we maybe another term is just mentors.
Yeah.
But you know, I think, you know, everybody should have a group of people that they feel like they can turn to talk, you know, ask for advice and to as a sounding board. And,
yeah.
and ideally, the more diverse that group is, the better. You know, they come from all walks of life. And so I made sure to, you know, so I had a lot of conversations with those folks.
Was there one nugget of wisdom that stands out?
Gosh, you know, thinking back to it, you know, I mean, I think that really, you know, thinking about what would scale look like, you know,
yeah.
we were really, you know, we had sort of convinced ourselves that we had a scalable thing, and it wasn't yet,
mm-hmm.
you know, So really figuring out what that was. You know, travel. I really love taking time to go and get creative inspiration just from seeing the world and what else is going on. And and so those two things were super important. And it, you know, I'm really thankful for that whole process. Sure. A, we learned a ton, and the carnival was a wonderful test. Beautifully, it lives on. We actually merged the whole program with a nonprofit.
They
became the Two Bit Circus Foundation. Yeah. And you know, as a for-profit, we threw two carnivals. Since then, they've thrown six or seven. The the last one just happened in Dallas a week ago.
Nice.
And the format has found its place and is now a complete replacement for the science fair.
Right.
Kids get to learn STEM and STEAM, building their own games, and then learn business throwing their own carnival. So it's more exciting than a science fair,
awesome.
And it's great, you know.
Yeah.
And so so out of this one thing, two things happened. That nonprofit is now running, and our amusement park is happening. So in on the balance, thank God, you know, I'm so grateful that we went through that process.
Yeah.
Freaking was terrible at the time, you know, totally sucked. But it really, you know, that scar tissue and that experience never could have happened otherwise. And I think going back to what we talked about earlier, we didn't go into this saying we're going to build an amusement park, right? We went into it building a carnival, and out of it, and that learning landed us where we are. And so back to the early recommendation from my dad around just like, get out there, try something immediately, you know? You learn so much from having engaged that it really sets you on your path. In fact, one of my easiest, best, favorite examples of this is, you know the game Bop It, the toy Bop It? That toy designer, awesome guy up in San Francisco, set out to make a more fun remote control for his TV.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody cared, nobody wanted it, you know. Mm-hmm. And after a little while, he was like, actually, what if this was just a toy? You know, but it took countless rejection for this remote control idea before it was landed as a toy and then became super successful toy, you know.
Yeah. So what is the thing, I'm sure there must have been a lot, but as you launch now the amusement business, right? How do you not kill yourselves? Like, what'd you take from that last thing? How do you approach this one differently?
Oh boy, I don't actually know if I've solved that
one
yet. You know, I will say, you know, I got married this year, which has been great.
Nice.
And you know, the time that I have with my wife is such sacred. Restorative time, you know, I find. And so that has been, that's definitely been helpful. I think, for the team, we have more structure than we've ever had before. Mm-hmm. And that structure comes with timelines and much more clarity than we had before. You know, when we were building the carnival, nobody knew what a steam carnival was, including us, right? We were just pulling it all together. And so we were through brute force and our bodies, you know, in the breach, able to build the thing. And I think we brought on enough people with experience building attractions and building amusement parks that we have a little more visibility into the process and can, you know, be a little more thoughtful, right? Work smart, not hard.
Right.
And so that's been helpful, but I will say, we haven't figured it out.
Sure.
Like, it's still freaking absolutely a total slog. And
I was here this weekend,
this last weekend, I'll be here this weekend. And,
of course,
you know, it definitely is a work in progress.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that, you know, there's things like riding a bike that you just learn once and you never forget. And then there's things like going to the gym and eating healthy that are just an active practice.
You have to learn
for
over and
sure
over.
This is one of those you have to learn over and over.
I'm sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think it forces you into a different frame of mind, right? Because once you open, you stay open. Right?
Yeah.
You got to operate the day after and the day after, and you know.
You know, and I really can't wait for that because I feel right now so sort of untethered from the metrics of, you know, of staying open and seeing what works and what doesn't work, and are we, you know, did people respond to that campaign or not respond? Like, is it working or not? And while we've been building the park and all the stuff inside it, we've been really untethered from that connectivity, and I love that connectivity.
Yeah.
And so I really am ecstatic to get open.
Yo, if you're liking all this technology talk, let's go back in the Rebel Radio archives. My man AJ Burtonshaw, who's the founder and CEO of Serato, which is the most ubiquitous DJ software technology. He's got some great stories about how he's built that company into a real powerhouse. Go to iTunes, Rebel Radio, or find us on SoundCloud and you can listen to that one. But of course, finish up here with Brent Bushnell.
So you talk, I know you've done a lot of work with brands, and you know, we've seen like the big, when we think of amusement parks, you know, we think of Disney, we think of Harry Potter World,
yep.
Right? They're very IP driven.
Yep. Many of them, you know, if we want to nerd out on it, there's a difference between a theme park and right. an amusement park.
Sure.
And a theme park, you described Disneyland, Universal Studios, very IP driven, themed.
Yeah.
Amusement parks oftentimes can be the more...
So like Six Flags.
Six Flags, a great
right.
example. Now, those are all adding more theming, and we will have theming in ours as well. We sort of started with micro amusement park to sort of set expectation lower. Mm-hmm. I would love to aspirationally get to micro theme park.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet.
Got it. But
you know, there hasn't been a new amusement park, new theme park built in America in 20 years,
yeah.
you know? I mean, there's huge, right? Acres and acres of space.
Sure.
And so for us, you know, micro was not an accidental addition, right? This is something, it's small for an amusement park, but still huge for a retail complex. So this
yeah.
could be a new anchor tenant for a mall.
Yeah.
But we feel like this size is right to be able to put into every major metro in the US.
So I was wondering, like, you know, what is it, like brands are struggling to capture people's attention.
Yeah.
Right? And you know, you go talk to any brand and the themes of storytelling come up and engagement.
Yeah,
and
immersive, experiential,
all of
these buzz
right?
terms, yeah.
And so, what do brands not know that they need to know about that?
You know, I think that, you know, at the end of the day, we like story, we relate to story, we have for millennia, you know, and to have that authentic bond, memories are made more permanent the more of your senses that are involved.
Mm.
Not only that, if you can tie some emotion there, even more permanent. And what's a brand looking for, right? They want to be lodged in your brain. They want to be lodged in your consciousness so that the time that you go to buy shoes, you're buying one over the other. By the time you go to buy napkins, you're buying one over the other. And so they're looking to be implanted in your brain. And so the thing that's so powerful about immersion over the banner ad is that's, you know, much more likely to be lodged in your brain. So the more senses of yours that I can engage, the more that there could be some, any emotion, you know, happiness, sadness, you know, even fear, you know, those things all are going to make this so much more permanent. And
yeah.
so the more that a brand can you know, tap into all of those aspects, you know, the more that they're going to be, you know, part of your lasting memory.
Literally on the way here, I was on a call with a brand telling me that, you know, awareness is their big metric for this campaign. And they were talking about how many people viewed their Facebook ad.
Yeah.
And I just had to say to them, that's not awareness.
That's not awareness.
Right? You're missing yeah. all of the other senses. I literally said those words. You're missing all the other senses.
Yeah.
It takes to create awareness because it's a microsecond
yeah.
of attention that people paid, and it's just not enough.
It's just not sufficient, you know. And it could be one part, right?
Yeah.
That Facebook thing could be
sure.
one piece
sure.
tied to a bunch of other stuff. But
yeah.
but that alone is so, and it's so misleading. And I think that a lot of the way that scale is portrayed, and the way that you know people talk about impact of number of impressions and all that, that stuff's good. But it can't stand alone.
It's not
you
the
know?
Whole story.
It's not the whole story, and it really can be misleading because yeah sure oh my gosh you know 100 people 1,000 people saw your thing live, but those are the 1,000 that might be your new evangelists.
Mm-hmm.
Right, those are the new
mm-hmm.
those are the group, that's the group that you've got for life, you
yeah.
know. I mean, I think about I'm such a loyal, when a brand gets you know, when I get close to a brand, I've used the exact same Old Spice deodorant since I was 14, you know.
Right.
Like,
sure,
like
yeah.
there's certain things that are just mine for good.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah,
absolutely. All right, I have to get to a lightning round before.
Oh yeah,
we,
all right, cool.
Before we let you go, I always do. James gets mad at me because I always do this, but there's one more question before
we get to
that. You have I saw a quote from you saying most people are antisocial.
Mm.
What does that mean?
I'm so glad to add more context to that. I wonder where that showed up. Because I think that in general, humans are very social.
Yes.
We are social in our core, right? We love, you know, community and you know, have been based on that for time immemorial. I think that we are part of a world that is increasingly antisocial, and the illusion of being on a social network and being social, that's not full social, right? To our earlier thing, it's not using all the senses, right? It's using just a handful of them, and so it's one way to interact. And yay, thank gosh, you know, for it. There's so many different ways in which I keep in touch with my friends because of all the technology we have, but at the same time, those opportunities to be real and social in person are things you really have to make a point to do. And so I think that a lot of our technology is increasingly isolating, even if we are, you know, you can be connected to 1,000 friends, but you're maybe not seeing them in person. I really think that's a piece that we are trying to attack, is getting people back together in person, you know, so that they can be reminded what it's like to be social and playing together again.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me one decision that changed your life forever.
Oh man. One decision that changed my life forever. I guess we can edit out this silence.
Yeah, absolutely. Take your time. We'll get there.
I want that to be good.
It could be that, you know, we make lots of mundane decisions that end up somewhere.
Building things. Making things. Making stuff. Making anything, you know, the decision to create is so life changing, and the second that you, and it does, I don't care what you build something, and it is so rewarding. And when you are building, whether it is a birthday card for your grandma, making that, not buying that, you know, a gift for a friend, an experience you want to provide your, you know, your parents, you know, the more build something.
Yeah.
And that is a really, you know, to go from being consumer to creator is something I wish on anybody.
I gotta tell you, I'm so glad I did not let you pass on that question, because I thought about it. I'm like, let me let him off the hook. But that's a fantastic answer. I have an 8-year-old son who just recently needed his third bike. He's to the 20-inch bike, and I decided we're gonna build it.
Nice.
And so we went and bought a shitty old frame.
Awesome.
And sandblasted it, and we started really from just scratch.
Incredible.
And he loves that bike.
He probably loves that bike. Yeah. Like, he never would if you guys had gone and bought it off the shelf and, you know, whatever.
Totally.
That is his thing for life, you know? And that is a really, and even well after it has fallen apart.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
It'll be his, you know? And it'll be in his brain as a thing that was, you know, as something that he brought into this world.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, I built my first computer, you know, not my first computer, I built one of my early computers. And, you know, hey, what does that mean? Did I mine silicon? And, you know, no, I assembled a bunch of components.
Right.
But even that level of, you know.
But it's way different than putting it in your Amazon cart and having it show up tomorrow.
Exactly. And all the parts arrived, and some of them were wrong, and I had to get different ones, and all of this stuff happened. And by the time it was done, that computer was mine, you know.
That's
cool. And that was something.
Okay, complete this sentence. I don't have talent, I have blank.
Enthusiasm.
So if I worked here, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
The 2-bit pitch.
Okay.
I feel like sometimes anybody in this place could probably give the tour that I give.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's what you want. Who would you be most excited to learn as a fan of your work?
Oh, man. Walt Disney.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. I know you mentioned travel earlier. What's your favorite city to travel to?
Oh God. So I'm obsessed with travel. I absolutely love Shanghai. Shanghai is incredible. You know, I mean, it is old world meets new world. Every time I'm back there, there's some crazy new huge thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's got all the old French colonial architecture in the West, and it's got all the sort of crazy new, you know, high tech in the East, and you know, I love Chinese food. I love Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. You know, that city is incredible. I love Copenhagen. Mm. You know, I've been obsessed with circus and carnival since I was little, and Tivoli Gardens, if you've been.
Yeah, we just went this summer for the first time.
It's a really cool place. Yeah. So those two I really love a lot.
Is there a book that's had, you think, the biggest impact on you? Or maybe the most recent one.
You know, there was a bunch that popped to mind. Paul Graham as an author is amazing. Mm. He is, you know, he was, you know, if you're familiar with Y Combinator, right? He started that. Before that, he did what ultimately became Yahoo Store. Mm-hmm. But is an incredible, in addition to doing those amazing things, is an incredible author. Mm. And he has a book, Hackers and Painters, that's gorgeous. But all of his essays, I recommend reading.
Oh, cool.
He's a really incredible author. I really love Paul Graham. I finished relatively recently Servant Leadership. The Servant is just an incredible book, and that whole concept, you know, I think particularly now as you know what leadership is really drawn into question of sort of what is a good leader and what is a bad leader.
Sure.
I think servant leadership is something I would love for anybody who leads anyone on the planet to read. Is a really great book. And then I mentioned earlier Night Circus, which is total fun and whimsical and gorgeous.
I got to check all those out, actually. What movie do you think you've seen the most in your life?
Oh man! So I love the movie Big Fish. I think I'm obsessed with circus and carnival. It's also a wonderful narrative around a father-son relationship that I think is really special. What else have I seen a lot? I've really watched Blade Runner a lot. I was so excited to see the recent one. I'm crushed that it didn't do well in the box office because it's a gorgeous movie. Yeah. It's really incredible.
Maybe still in streaming.
Maybe in the long tail, but man, it's just so good. And the set design and all the thoughtfulness, it's just incredible. So I really loved that. And for some reason, you know, this sort of doesn't track with I think your intent of the question, but I've seen Terminator 2 so many times, but it's not that it's necessarily my favorite.
But we get a lot of those, like, it's not my favorite, but I keep seeing it anyway.
It was like, I think it came out at a time in life when, you know, it was like one of the early VHS tapes that I owned myself. It was like I actually owned it as opposed to, you know, it's somebody else's, and it was for some reason I ended up seeing that a lot.
No, all none of my favorite movies are the ones I've seen the most.
You're right.
Absolutely. That's how it works. Yeah. Favorite band or DJ?
Oh man, I love Caravan Palace so much. Cool. Caravan Palace is, you know, if I had one wish to be able to collaborate with a band for our park, it would be Caravan Palace.
Really?
Oh yeah. Oh my God, I want to do something with them so badly. So I just love them a lot.
That's cool. Awesome. And so how does everyone find out about Two Bit Circus?
So twobitcircus.com. You know, I would say the best thing is we've got a newsletter that is where the earliest access to stuff happens.
Nice.
Our amusement park, micro amusement park, opens in downtown LA early next year. Newsletter will be the first to know.
Awesome.
And then, you know, we've got we're on the Twitters, and you know, I put stuff out at Brent Bushnell, all one word, pretty regularly,
and
we just can't wait to bring people down and have some fun.
Killer. Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, Josh, thank you so much. This has been really fun and wonderful.
Yeah,
really appreciate it.
Right on.
Yo, that was Brent Bushnell, Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Make sure you watch for the launch of Two Bit Circus when it comes next year. And make sure you stay in touch with Rebel Radio. Hit us with some comments on Twitter at Rebel Radio Net. Find us on Facebook. Check out our YouTube page. Leave us a review on iTunes. Do whatever you feel like, but make sure you come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.